From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. In western Germany, more than 100 people are dead in catastrophic flooding. The banks of the Rhine River and its tributaries swelled with historic rainfall, washing away homes, setting off landslides. Across Western Europe, more than 1,000 people are missing as rescue crews struggle against the rising waters. For more, let's go to Ajit Naranjan. He is an environment reporter for Deutsche Welle in Berlin. Ajit, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
These are just awful images. Cars piled up in streets choked with debris, rooftops poking out above the water, entire hillsides washed away. How widespread is the damage?
So what you're describing there is happening mainly across two states within Germany, Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia, the second being the most populous state of the whole country. But it's also stretched out across Northern Europe. So, I mean, the scenes in Belgium and also in the Netherlands are also shocking. I mean, this is exactly the sort of climate catastrophe that scientists have been warning for years. It's becoming more likely as temperatures rise. And it's striking to see it happen even in countries as rich as, Germany and Belgium.
Mm. We'll get to the climate consequences in just a moment. But first, I mean, there's a crisis on the ground now as we speak. And it looks like people were very much caught off guard. I mean, how uncommon is flooding like this in the region?
So some scientists have put this very roughly down as a sort of once in a century sort of event. Heavy rainfall is becoming heavier and heavier. And people in these regions are not used to this scale of flooding. The idea of these kind of flooding to such catastrophic degrees and setting off landslides, as you said, is something that people are just not used to here.
Hmm. What kind of flood protection exists already in Germany? I apparently couldn't stand up to this rainfall.
Yes, I mean, all rivers here, all big rivers have these kind of flood defenses. There are barriers to stop them. These aren't built to withstand such unexpectedly strong floods. We had huge amounts of rainfall that didn't move very quickly. So the kind of depression, the atmospheric depression, meant that this kind of storm was just stuck over this one area, these few areas. That means that the kind of existing flood protections aren't able to cope over that longer time period.
Well, the German Environment Minister tweeted yesterday that climate change has arrived in Germany. And of course, this flooding comes in a week when the European Union announced its ambitious plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What is the link between these floods and these downpours and global warming and climate change? Or is it just too soon to know?
So what leading climate scientists, both in Germany and across the world, have already said over the last couple of days is that climate change makes heavy rains like even heavier. And it's going to make them even heavier and even heavier as long as people keep burning fossil fuels that kind of release gases, trapping sunlight, heating the planet. But specifically in this case, I mean, there are other factors that may also be making it worse, like climatic changes to the jet stream or storms kind of moving more slowly, as we just talked about, lingering over an area. What scientists all do seem to very much agree on is this very simple principle of physics, which is that warmer air holds more moisture.
I don't know what the feeling there is generally amongst Germans on this issue of climate change, but do you think an emergency like this will open people's eyes to the climate crisis if they haven't already been?
Yes, I think you can clearly see that it is opening eyes. Politicians are talking about it. Leading senior politicians from across the political spectrum are talking about it. Scientists are calling it out. Journalists are talking about it in kind of the political broadcasts. I think you could almost compare it to the wildfires in the Pacific Northwest, in that when scientists can quickly attribute or quickly explain to the public to what extent global warming and climate change played a role in making extreme weather more extreme, then people do confront that. People have to reckon with that, and politicians have to react to that. Climate awareness is relatively high in Germany. There's not very much climate denial. But what's maybe not so common here is this feeling that it really affects people here. And when you see headlines saying things like 8 people, or at least 9 people, 9 to 12 people with disabilities have been killed by floods, then it's something that's very hard to look away from. So I think people are definitely waking up to it. The question is maybe just whether they're waking up fast enough for the necessary changes.
Ajit Naranjan is an environment reporter for Deutsche Welle in Berlin. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
In Afghanistan, a Taliban surge as the U.S. leaves is rattling many of the country's neighbors. In recent weeks, insurgents have gained control of key border posts with Iran, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. Amid the violence, a Reuters photographer, Danish Siddiqui, was killed today covering the fighting between the Taliban and Afghan forces near a border crossing with Pakistan. Michael Kugelman is deputy director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center. He's on Skype. Michael, how worried are Afghanistan's neighbors about the Taliban taking control of these border crossings?
Well, it's very concerning just because it appears that the Taliban will be in a position to dictate the flow of border trade, which will allow it to make a lot of money, among other things. And I think more broadly, the fact that the Taliban is so close to these bordering states is really quite concerning, and I think on the whole amplifies concerns for neighboring countries about the possible spillover effects of this increasing destabilization in Afghanistan, which could range from refugee flows to the risk of a higher flow of the drug trade emanating from Afghanistan, and also the risk of terrorism and terrorist groups in Afghanistan that pose a threat to the broader neighborhood.
Russia, of course, has its own troubled history with fighting a war in Afghanistan, but I'm wondering, does Moscow see opportunity in Afghanistan with the U.S. leaving?
I mean, certainly it's easy to think that with the U.S. on its way out, it's going to leave a vacuum that its major rivals like Russia and China and Iran will be able to fill. But I don't know if I would go that far, just because the security situation in Afghanistan is so incredibly volatile and violent, that I think that even if these countries like Russia would want to try to capitalize on the U.S. departure to deepen their own footprint in the country, they're not going to have many options, just because there's so little they could do in such a violent environment that Afghanistan is experiencing right now.
The other big power in that region, of course, is China. It shares just a narrow border with Afghanistan. And Beijing is trying to shore up its own ties with its Central Asian neighbors. Talk more about China's interests in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I would argue that China has two major interests or concerns in Afghanistan. One is a desire to be able to bring its infrastructure projects, especially those associated with its Belt and Road Initiative, into Afghanistan. But it really has not been able to do that because of the war. China has shown a willingness to tolerate a lot of risk in terms of making investments in many volatile parts of the world. If you look at its agricultural investments in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. But in Afghanistan, it's held back. It has not been a major economic player in Afghanistan. And it wants to change that. Its other concern is terrorism. China really worries about a terrorist group that goes by the acronym TIP, which is mainly comprised of Uyghur militants. And this is a group that many, including myself, think that China exaggerates the threat posed by this group. It tends to do, it's done a lot more fighting in Syria than it has in Afghanistan. But China believes that it's a big threat. And unfortunately, it uses this group as a pretext to crack down in horrible ways on its Uyghur community. And the question is, how does China deal with these two issues? One thing it may do is try to quietly reach out to the Taliban to try to reach some sort of understanding where, for instance, the Taliban agrees not to target infrastructure projects that China may want to build in areas controlled by the Taliban. And perhaps also China will try to get the Taliban to agree to deny space to these terrorists that China worries about.
Let's focus on Pakistan for a moment. It shares a long border and a tense relationship with Afghanistan. Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. spoke with NPR's Morning Edition. You can hear how carefully he measures his words. Let's listen to Ambassador Asad Majid Khan.
We have no favorites. Anyone that is acceptable to the people of Afghanistan is acceptable to Pakistan. And we have urged Taliban to, refrain from pushing for a military victory. And I think it is time for the Afghan government to also show flexibility.
React to that and talk a bit just about the nature of the relationship. It's complicated between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's very complicated. But not only is the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan complicated, the relationship between Pakistan and the Taliban is complicated. Yes, Pakistan has these close ties to the Taliban. It was one of the few countries to recognize the Taliban regime in the 1990s. But there are some things that the two groups disagree on, such as the issue of the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which the Taliban actually does not recognize, like most Afghans. So it's very complicated and very complex. But at the end of the day, there's no regional player other than Pakistan that has so much leverage over the Taliban. Even if it doesn't have as much leverage as it used to for whatever reason, it has that long-standing relationship with the Taliban, and that makes it a really critical player in this regard.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director for the Asia Program at the Wilson Center. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Friday, so let's say we loosen things up a bit and listen to some classic Chicago blues. Give me back my wit, and then I'll let your head go. Give me back my wit, and then I'll let your head go. That is Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rockers performing Give Me Back My Wig. Yes, you heard that right. The song is Give Me Back My Wig. It's from an album called 50 Years of Genuine House Rockin' Music, put out by Alligator Records, an independent legendary label in Chicago, to celebrate 50 years of recording great blues artists such as Coco Taylor, Albert Collins, James Cotton, and Shamika Copeland, who joins us now to talk about Chicago blues, Alligator Records, and her career. Shamika, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you for having me. This is so exciting.
So you grew up listening to Hound Dog Taylor and his House Rockers, and this was the record that started it all for Alligator Records. What does Hound Dog Taylor's music mean to you?
Oh, wow. Well, I was a fan of Hound Dog Taylor and pretty much all the artists on Alligator Records growing up, because they were pumping out records like crazy of all these wonderful artists. And so they were my go-to. And it means a lot, because these days, you know, it's what you have to hold on to. You know, it's a part of our history, a part of our culture.
What makes a song a Chicago blues song? I don't want to get all academic here, but how do you answer that question?
To me, it's a perfect mix, because so many of the artists that are known as Chicago blues artists now, they left Mississippi and came to Chicago and then found a sound, you know? So they brought all the goodness from where they came from with them and then made it into their own in Chicago.
So genuine house rockin' music is Alligator Records' official slogan. Let's listen to another great song from the label. It's called I'm a Woman, and it's by the Coco Taylor. When I was a little girl, only 12 years old, I couldn't do nothing to save my doggone soul. Told me the day I was grown, she said, sing the blues, child, sang it from now on. I'm a woman, oh yeah, I'm a woman, I'm a ball of fire. I hate to talk over it, but Coco Taylor was called the queen of the blues. Why?
Oh, because she most certainly was. That's been my ringtone for 20 years, by the way, that song. she just embodied everything that a queen should. I mean, she had it all. The voice, the personality, the stage presence. I absolutely adored her, and I miss her.
On that particular song, she takes a blues standard and makes it her own and turns it into a woman's anthem instead of kind of this macho thing that,
absolutely.
That maybe it had been.
There was a whole lot of I'm a man songs, so she said, I'm going to turn this around. And that's exactly what she did. And it's just such a great song.
What kind of an inspiration has she been to you in your career?
Oh, my gosh. One of the biggest, actually, because not only did I grow up listening to her, but later on, I got a chance to get to know her, be friends with her, and work with her. I did a lot of shows opening for her. I was just brand new, and she just gave me all kinds of great advice that I really appreciated and still use to this day.
What's the best piece of advice she gave you?
She told me that you're going to have some good gigs and some bad gigs, some good days and some bad days, but you just pick yourself up and keep going and look to the hills. That's what she always told me, look to the hills. And I knew exactly what it meant.
Okay, here's a song called Black Cat Bone, and you know what I'm leading up to. It features the singing and the guitar playing of your father, Johnny Copeland.
I walked down from Dallas, Texas, down to Wichita Falls. I got to thinking about the big leg woman. There wasn't no walking on. I believe my baby got a black cat bone. Look like everything I do is wrong.
Shamika Copeland, tell us about your dad and about his own legacy at Alligator Records.
Wow. It was, to me, one of the best blues records ever made. And it won a Grammy Award. So I was really, really proud of that. To me, my dad was the most incredible artist in the whole world. But, you know, I'm biased.
He wasn't so bad, though.
No.
And I'm not biased. He took you on the road where you actually began singing at a very early age. What did he teach you about being a blues artist?
Gosh, I learned so much from my dad. One of my favorite things he always used to say is when you go on stage, you always give it 100%. And I saw him do that. And so I always do that.
I understand one of your favorites from the anniversary album is Ain't Seen My Baby by Cephas and Wiggins. Let's hear some of that.
She got great big legs built up from the ground. She got great big legs that she built up from the ground. And when she started loving, my love come tumbling down.
That harmonica is really great. Tell us about Cephas and Wiggins.
That's just what I was about to say. I love them together as a duo. The guitar playing, the harmonica playing. And I just really enjoyed their songs, you know. Just that lyric, you know. She got great big legs and she wiggles all around. I mean, it just makes me smile. It makes me happy.
Let's hear another one. This is from Mavis Staples. People think of her as a gospel singer and a soul singer, but she is also on this Alligator Records 50th anniversary collection. Here's Mavis.
It's a sign of the times. You can feel it in the air. You can see it on the faces of people everywhere. You can hear it on the street. You can see it on the news. Lord, I do believe there's a devil on the loose.
It's a blues song, but that's still Mavis, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like me. I always say that I'm a blues singer. So no matter what I sing, no matter what genre it is, it sounds like blues. And she's a gospel singer. So no matter what she sings, it sounds like gospel to me. And she gives me goose pimples every time I hear her. Just an incredible artist.
I want to talk about your own impressive career singing and playing the blues. You and your latest album, it's called Uncivil War, have won all sorts of blues awards this past year.
Uncivil War. Uncivil war, same old wounds, we open.
sure you're right. I'm sure you're wrong. Why can't we all just get along?
I hear some gospel in there. Tell me about that song.
And I just hated to see the direction that we were going to as a country. All the divisiveness and it was just heartbreaking to me. How long must we fight this uncivil war? How long do we have to continue doing the same things that we're doing before we realize that we are all Americans and we all belong here and we shouldn't hate on one another?
How much do you feel like you and the success you're having now is carrying on both the legacy and the tradition of Alligator Records?
Well, you know, I really like to think that Alligator, they have allowed me to evolve and grow, and they just accept whatever I throw at them, you know, banjos and fiddles and just all different styles of music that I'm incorporating into blues, because to me, you know, we're all cousins anyway, so it's like, why can't I just play with all of them? And they accept that from me, and I appreciate that.
Shamika Copeland is a blues singer whose work is heard on Alligator Records' 50th anniversary release, 50 years of genuine house rockin' music. Shamika Copeland, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nobody wins on Civil War.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out, who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect? Listen now to every episode of the new podcast, On Our Watch, from NPR and KQED.
The breakdown of the Texas power grid during a severe storm in February caused havoc in the state's energy markets. Now there are charges of manipulation against some big energy companies. Mose Bushell from member station KUT in Austin reports.
The days leading up to February's big freeze were nerve-wracking for CPS Energy, San Antonio's city-owned utility. Demand for electricity and heating would be huge. To prepare, the utility had to make sure it had enough electricity contracted and enough natural gas to supply its customers and fuel its own power plants. But then something else started happening, says CEO Paula Gold-Williams.
So as we were watching this, we started seeing first natural gas prices start to escalate.
First they doubled, then tripled. And that was before the storm hit. Gold-Williams says once the state was frozen and in the grip of the worst blackout in its history, electricity prices hit their market cap. Some natural gas prices were 15,000% higher. In many cases, utilities had no choice but to buy.
It would be like you going to fill up your gas tank during the storm, and you go to the gas station, instead of paying $50-ish to fill up your tank, you know, the register there reads, give me $6,000 to $7,000.
The thing is, jacking up the price of gasoline during a disaster is clearly illegal in Texas. But it's not clear whether the same thing is true for what happened to natural gas prices. In Texas's deregulated energy market, high prices during times of energy scarcity are expected. CPS Energy says this was different, that it was the victim of price gouging. And it's one of several utilities suing natural gas suppliers and the group that operates the state's electric grid. The state and a federal agency are also investigating what happened.
We teach the electricity game in school.
Energy economist Ed Herz at the University of Houston believes market manipulation actually happens a lot in Texas. It can be done by holding back the product itself, the gas or the electricity, or manipulating the contracts for those products on the financial markets.
When producers, when generators can combine and withhold power from the market, they can drive the price up.
The gas companies being sued and the state's electric grid operator deny any wrongdoing. In a statement, Energy Transfer Partners says its pricing was transparent, and CPS was simply the victim of its own poor planning. Either way, proving any price gouging could be tricky. Energy analysts say a number of states have clearer laws and more oversight, but the Texas gas market is largely one of private deals between buyers and sellers. Beth Garza is a former independent market monitor for the state's electric grid who spent years investigating fraud. She says in Texas there are rules against market manipulation in the electricity sector, but not really in natural gas.
You know, if your market doesn't have any rules against withholding, people will withhold because it's profitable.
In San Antonio, CPS Energy's Paula Gold Williams says that's all the more reason to sue.
This is why we're fighting a fight that has never been seen in Texas before, because the market didn't work.
She hopes the courts will establish a definition for what constitutes price gouging for natural gas in Texas. For NPR News, I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
Young adults who've aged out of foster care are navigating life without the same kind of safety net that many of us have. And of course, the pandemic has made it that much harder. We recently spoke with Phoenix Ramirez, 21 years old, who entered foster care in Oregon when he was 6. In March of 2020, he turned 18 and aged out of the system.
Literally, the judge signed the papers of like, you're no longer have a case, a week before everything shut down. And then when everything shut down, I really had like no resources available to me. My whole life kind of got like flipped on side of its head. At the time, I was living at the dorms in my college, and they decided to shut down the dorms, so I was about to be homeless. All my jobs opportunities just went flat too, so I lost a lot of my income as well. And unfortunately, the timing of everything just made it so that DHS and Child Protective Services and foster care just couldn't help me at all because I just closed my case.
Thankfully for Phoenix, the COVID relief package passed late last year included support for teenagers and young adults who've spent time in foster care. The money will help Phoenix keep his head above water.
Just recently, I just learned about the COVID relief package having funds specifically for foster youth. And most states have up to $2,000 available for former foster youth. And I applied for that. And I just actually got news today that I got approved for it. So I'm planning on using those funds to purchase a new car so that way I can start back into work again, because for me I'm an actor. I work in the entertainment industry, so I have to travel a lot.
But if you've aged out of the system and you don't have help from social workers anymore, it's tough to know what kind of help is available.
I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get funding, but luckily I did.
This is Hillary. She asked us to use her first name for privacy. Hillary is 24, aged out at 18. She lives in a different state now than she did when she was in foster care, so that's made getting the COVID relief money more complicated.
I was able to use some of that emergency funding to like buy a bed and like dishes, and basically I had like nothing but a couple of suitcases and an apartment. So it ended up working out in the end, and it was like a long and very stressful process, but the years after foster care have been long and stressful, so I'm sort of used to that.
Hillary tells us that the pandemic actually helped in one way. She realized that growing up the way she did and dealing with so much uncertainty has made her resilient.
I'm very happy and grateful because now I have somewhere to live, and this is like the first time that I've ever had like a safe, welcoming place to call home.
And Hillary, this is me tipping my hat to you. And let's keep talking about this with Vivek Sankaran. He is director of the Child Advocacy Law Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. He works with people like Phoenix and Hillary all the time and others in the foster care system. Vivek, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And boy, aging out of the foster care system is a tough road, even in the best of times. How much harder did the pandemic make it for these young adults?
It is so much harder, Peter. I mean, if you think, as you flagged, it is always difficult for a child aging out of foster care because they lose all the supports that they had in the system, a lawyer, a social worker, a place to live. And during the pandemic, what we saw is that many of these supports fell away quickly, and these youth were asked to navigate the world on their own, but it was a world where everything became more difficult, right? Getting a job, getting a house, being connected with those who could support them. And for my clients and other youth that I know, it was a real struggle.
Hmm. Do you think that's a temporary problem, or will this be something that they kind of grapple with for years?
So I have to say what the pandemic did was it really exposed a lot of the flaws within our foster care system. And one of the real tragedies in our system is how we deal with children aging out of foster care. This kind of revealed a longstanding problem and our need to provide these children with, we need to surround them with much more than we're doing right now to have a much smoother transition. But of course, the real solution is preventing this from happening in the first instance, which is probably where we should be investing most of our time.
And as you know, it wasn't just tough for teenagers aging out. The AP reported recently that family reunifications dropped dramatically during the pandemic. So did adoption. So all the way across the spectrum here. What else have you seen happening?
Yeah, in so many ways, this pandemic has impacted families. I mean, from parents not being able to visit children, from kids who are ready to be sent home, not being able to go home. It's affected, you know, every aspect of the system. So, for example, in Michigan, we had hundreds of kids ready to go home, but then courts closed down. And for kids to be sent home, you need court orders. And kids were languishing in foster care, even though they were ready to be home. And luckily, we came up with an innovative sort of pilot project to try to get all these orders generated outside of court. But it really revealed that so much of what we do in foster care involves like going to a physical space and talking to a judge and getting an order signed. And it's got a lot of us to think about different ways that we should be moving forward to make this system far more efficient so we can get better outcomes for families.
Are the courts back to normal yet?
No, and I don't even know kind of what normal will look like moving forward. And so, you know, we have many courts still holding hearings virtually. Many trials have been delayed. And you're talking about trials involving really key questions about whether a child was abused or neglected, whether parental rights should be terminated. And kids and families have been in limbo as a result of that. And so as we slowly emerge from the pandemic, you're getting courts clearing a lot of the backlog and a lot of the delays. And the problem, you know, is that for kids, that their sense of time, you know, doesn't stop during a pandemic, right? They're forming relationships and attachments. So you're seeing a lot of really difficult situations where kids have been out of home for quite some time, but parents haven't been afforded a fair opportunity, you know, to do what they need to do to reunify with their children. And so it's a real challenge right now all across the country.
You make such a good point. All of this is lost time, which for families and for kids, it's like it's impossible to get that back in a really critical, important time in these people's lives. What are the impacts of that?
You're absolutely right. I mean, what we're talking about for kids is their lives have been in limbo for 6 months, a year, you know, more than that. And you're talking about parents who, you know, I think of a client of mine who has been battling a longstanding substance abuse addiction, and she was finally ready to get treatment inpatient when a bed opened up. And then the day that she was supposed to go in, she had a cough and she wasn't allowed to go into the program because of, I get it, because of COVID, right? Because of fears of spreading this horrible disease. She's just one of many, many parents that I've heard from across the country that have been trying to get help, trying to get services, trying to access the relationships they need, but none of that was available. And so, you know, there's a lot of patience and empathy needed as we sort of struggle out of this this dynamic.
Well, let me tell you something. This story hits close to home for me. I adopted my daughters from foster care in February and in April of last year, right as the virus was shutting down cities. The court system in Boston, where we were living, shut down. One of the adoptions was delayed for quite a bit. This is a system that is incredibly difficult to navigate. I know that firsthand. I've experienced it. And it's not just for the adoptive parents or for the birth parents, but it's for the kids, of course, and the teachers and the social workers. I mean, as you said, this really shed light on the weaknesses in the system already. So as we emerge from this pandemic, do you think it's possible to find a system that doesn't just go back to normal, but maybe even could be prepared to become something a little bit better? Or is that just being optimistic?
No, you know, so I'm an optimist, and I think that there is space that has emerged in this pandemic driven by empathy, right? That this idea that life is fragile for so many of us. And I think people are feeling that a little bit right now. And I think they're reimagining how we can support families. And you know, my own view is that what we need to be doing is to move upstream and thinking about how we can support families so that kids don't have to enter foster care, and that We have a smaller number of kids, if they need to enter it, that we can deal with their needs in a much more holistic and appropriate way. But I see some space. I see a glimmer of hope that you're hearing more and more conversations about giving families the types of concrete supports that they need, income, access to housing, employment, that all the studies that I've ever seen have shown that those are the things that really drive down reports to Child Protective Services. And so that's my hope, that's my dream, that we can move away from this reactive conversation we've had for so many years about what are we going to do on the tail end after we've already traumatized a child in foster care for years, and can we reimagine what we do and do something that's bigger and different in terms of how to support families.
Vivek Sankaran is director of the Child Advocacy Law Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you need more proof of just how dominant streaming services have become, look no further than the Emmys. The award ceremony unveiled its 2021 nominations this week, and 7 of the 10 most nominated shows were created for platforms like Netflix, Disney Plus, and Hulu. Even the once mighty movie industry is bowing to the small screen as more people watch new releases at home rather than in theaters. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to discuss this. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So what does this batch of Emmy nominations tell you about the state of the TV industry?
Well, I mean, it seems as far as the industry is concerned, when it comes to high quality television, more and more of that is being found in streaming. You know, it makes all kinds of sense. I mean, we had this sort of streaming war breakout where all these big media companies spent a ton of money building their streaming services. And so it would make sense that we would reach this point where so many of these shows that we view as high quality and well done, big stars, were created for streaming services that could back up the money truck and create special programming that almost feels like a movie, but it's on streaming.
Something else stands out as we look at these nominations: an unusually large number of Black actors up for nomination, and the first transgender person to earn a nomination in a lead acting category. MJ Rodriguez from FX's show Pose. Here's what she said on Extra after hearing about her nomination.
I never thought a girl like me would get an opportunity to have a moment like this. It just feels so, so good. I feel so happy. I feel so seen. I feel represented, and I'm thankful.
So do you think the Television Academy has made real progress in recognizing diversity this year?
Yeah, I think they have. I'm pretty sure that in every major acting category, there was at least one person of color who was nominated. Now, one of the things that I noticed is that an awful lot of that diversity is coming from Black performers and shows centered on Black people, which is wonderful. But one of the big problems that we have in entertainment is that when we look at underrepresentation, it often comes from Latinos and Hispanics. And Asians as well were having problems with representation. So it's great to see so much diversity, but I think it's now time for Hollywood to stop seeing diversity as equals Black. It's time for Hollywood to see diversity as equaling all kinds of people of color and spread that wealth around a little bit.
Yeah. Turning to the entertainment industry as a whole, audiences are also staying home to watch new movies. Theaters are closing all over the country. For myself, I went out to a local movie theater last week to see the great documentary Summer of Soul about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. I could have streamed it, but it's one I thought I needed to see in a more communal way. Plus, I mean, Sly Stone and Nina Simone and Stevie Wonder, right?
Here we go.
But that's what it took to get me into a movie theater. And Eric, I've heard people say that the movie industry has surrendered to streaming. I mean, do you agree?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was still grooving to Stevie. Yeah. So, I think what's happening is what you did. People are deciding that the theatrical experience in a movie theater is something that takes special effort, and often it costs more. And so you are going to save that effort for the projects that really make sense for you. We saw the Black Widow movie, for example, that opened in theaters and also was available through streaming. And they still made tens of millions of dollars from the theatrical release because it's the kind of movie that you really want to see in a theater, the rest of the audience around you screaming when great things happen and reacting with you as you watch the movie. But other movies are not necessarily worth that effort, or they're better experienced in the intimacy of your home. And I just think people are being much pickier now about when they're going to make that effort to go out to the theater. What that's also doing, though, is that is encouraging the industry to take these sort of mid-level projects that normally would have been mid-level movies and turn them into TV shows or turn them into streaming limited series. People might not necessarily go to the movie theater to see a Mayor of Easttown movie, but they will very happily click onto HBO or HBO Max to see that very same thing stretched out over 7 or 8 episodes and brought into their home.
Eric, before we let you go, we're going to need a recommendation from you. What's the thing people should be binging right now?
Okay, I got two. First is a docuseries on Netflix about the tennis star Naomi Osaka. It's really revealing, and it's really an amazing experience to watch. And then there's a comedy called This Way Up that's on Hulu about these two Irish sisters who are living in London. One of them was suicidal. The other one is worried about taking care of her. And as the series progresses, their roles switch. So these two shows, really, really great. Naomi Osaka on Netflix and This Way Up on Hulu.
All right, book it. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.